Let us start off today with a meditation along what may prove to be unusual lines. So let the body be as free as possible of all muscular tensions, especially the abdominal region, the neck. Let the head be perfectly poised upon the neck, relaxed lower jaw, but not to the extent that your mouth opens. Let the muscles round the eyes release. Let the whole body be at ease. Now the important thing is that it should be perfectly poised, perfectly balanced, so that after a few moments no muscular tension arises. And then let the breath rhythm gradually establish itself, your own individual breath rhythm. Now, remain perfectly still. This is very important. Let the body be absolutely still in this state of ease and comfort, and the breath rhythm extremely peaceful. Maintain that stillness if the stillness of the body is perfect and the rhythm of the breath doesn't fluctuate. You may find certain very interesting things happen. First, bear in mind that when the body is absolutely still and the breath rhythm does not fluctuate, the whole psychophysical organism is in tune, in complete harmony, in its own unique way, with the dual rhythm of the earth. The rotation of the earth round its own axis and the revolution of the earth round the sun. These are the two fundamental rhythms upon which all life and the whole and all that happens in earth and on earth takes place, is based on those two fundamental rhythms and takes place. So then, the organism has ceased to obstruct the fundamental rhythms of existence in this world, to be out of joint with them. You may find that the most favorable times to practice this sort of thing if you're really serious about it, is either when you go to bed, let the body become perfectly restful lying in bed, perfectly free of all tensions, and let the rhythm of the breath get established. And then let the body remain absolutely still. So either when you go to bed or after waking up, don't get out of bed, but when you are awake and the brain is quite clear, especially if you've had a truly refreshing sleep, don't let the brain rush into the turmoil of daily thoughts, the things to do, and so forth. Just let the brain be quiet. And let the body be perfectly still and the rhythm of the breath established. Now you will find after a time, you may find, I should say, after a time, that the sense functions are all remarkably peaceful. They are pacified. Of course, you are not actually using your senses in the usual way, seeing things, hearing things. You can't avoid hearing the birds or the traffic or whatever it is. But apart from that, the activity of the senses, the sense functions, and all that comes to the surface of the conscious mind through recollection, through memory, is completely stilled. You are in a state of true repose consciously. You are in a similar state of repose, not exactly the same, but similar state of repose in dreamless slumber. But here, you are conscious, you are awake, and you are in this state of perfect repose. It is the state in which, as I said earlier, you are in tune with the fundamental rhythms of the earth. You are in harmony with life itself. Now, if you continue like that, and try and sort of experience it now if possible, just let it happen, don't try to bring it about, you will find that the sense functions come to their ending. Although the brain may register sounds that you hear, they will produce no reaction out of the mind. They will just be sounds. If the scent of flowers wafts across, the mind will just register the perfume of flowers and nothing else, with no reaction from the mind. Now this is a state of real meditating, the cessation of the superficial disturbances of the mind. You will find, above all, that with the absence of reaction from the mind, there will be no chattering going on in the brain. One will really become silent. Silent with respect to all the sense functions, sight, sound, taste, touch, etc. As I said a little while ago, you will notice that the senses come to their ending. That is the first noticeable factor. Thereafter, with the cessation of the chattering by the brain, the talking back at life, discursive thought will come to its ending. Now there is an extremely deep significance to this. Discursive thought and words represent the totality of our finite, limited existence in time and space. When they come to their ending, but one is awake, then one is awake in the inner depths of the mind, because all the superficial disturbance has ceased. And attention, consciousness, can be aware, awake to this inner depth of mind, where there is no talking, no passing of thoughts, which are thought forms, thought shapes, whose origin is only the sense impressions in our ordinary daily life. This is one of the ways of entering into the real deep samadhi. This, mind you, is entering into it. Now, in this state of awakenedness, after a time, you will find that so many ideas, convictions, beliefs, doctrines, the usual forms of thought, the usual restricted modes in which we are aware of and we present the world and our life, all our conditioning, in short, will no longer affect us. And it itself will undergo dissolution, the conditioning will. It will undergo dissolution. Emotions, thoughts, ideas, feelings, everything will be in repose, perfectly still. And you will begin to know something of that state which in the Upanishads has been called the yoga nidra, the yoga sleep, or the gudha shukti, which means the secret, hidden slumber, which is awake. That's the curious part of it. In this state of repose, of perfect peace, in which, as Patanjali puts in his aphorisms of yoga, he starts them off by saying, yogas chitta vritti nirodha, meaning yoga is the complete pacification of the transformations in thought of the mind. With that state of repose and the cessation of the external disturbance, the true creative activity which man is capable of can begin. Now bear in mind, this creative activity is quite different from what we commonly understand as creative action, creative work. We use that term significantly and most naturally in relation to the creative artist, the genius. Now what your great artist or your scientist or your philosopher produces is an expression of creative activity, but it is not a pure expression untouched by the deficiencies of finitude. Simply because the material which artist, scientist, and philosopher use is drawn from the finite, limited world of sense impressions and discursive thought. This creative activity is something which you can never speak of. You can't imagine it, you can't visualize it. But it goes on. Some of the signs of this creative activity is some of the signs are the changes which take place in the psychophysical organism itself. You, the living existent in this world. It is almost as if the very cells of the body undergo transformation of some sort or other. It is very significant, most significant, that when the Buddha talks of the deep jhanas and their effect upon one, he simply keeps on saying that the whole body is suffused with a sense of ease. We know the ease which we experience when we sink into a very comfortable armchair. But this, that ease has nothing whatsoever, no relationship. No relationship to this other ease which emerges in the body itself. And indeed, in the psyche, in the psychophysical whole, for the very simple reason that with the release from the strains and stresses of conflicting duals in terms of ideas, beliefs, emotions and all the rest of it, the whole psyche undergoes that kind of transformation into a completely pure state which affects the physical cells themselves. Plunging back into ordinary life, the cells can get re-poisoned, so to say. But since that is the case, one appreciates and understands why, when the yogi, the religious, enters the deep samadhi, it is not a once and for all achievement, so to say, like taking your university exam or presenting your thesis and getting your PhD. It's not like that. It has to be repeated. It's a life process, a living process. But in small ways, one can make a beginning like this. And you will find that this dissolution of all the obstructive conditioning of the psyche, the body, the mind with its ideas and so forth, that with the dissolution of all that, there comes an extraordinary sense of light, of clarity. Of freedom and of peace. That peace is very important. You know how the holy ones always bless people with the words, "Peace be with you. Peace be with you." Remember Jesus' words, "My peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth," because the world cannot give it like that, "but my peace I give unto you." This peace is extremely important, because this peace is the source of strength, which is utterly free of all violence or the possibility of violence. And it is, if it is free of the possibility even of violence, then it is totally free of all evil. This strength is associated with, is a remarkable characteristic of this inner spiritual life in us. This strength is not forcefulness in our ordinary sense. It never imposes itself. The spiritually strong never argue, never quarrel. They are in the state of repose under all conditions and in all circumstances. In this peace and strength, If you can still maintain the perfect quietness of the body and the rhythm of the breath and remain awake, you will experience in a quite indescribable way this power which we call compassion welling out of your whole psychophysical being. Compassion for all the world, because all the world is in the ill state, is suffering. And the movement and activity of all the world is a disturbance of the surface waters of the ocean of life. So there will be compassion. The important point is the stillness of the body and the mind, together with the rhythm of the breath. It is wise to practice this in the morning when you have no cause for hurry, getting to the office or whatever it is. Now, I've said that you will find that all sense functioning, thought and so forth will come to its ending. And you will experience this state of light. That light too will come to its ending. And you might say, but heavens, what then is there? This sounds like annihilation. Far from it. A totally new dimension of being and consciousness springs into existence, fills you, is unobstructed by the peaceful body and psyche. This this ending of everything that can be conceived and spoken of, including the state of light, does not mean that you are lost in vacuity, in a state of nothingness. On the very contrary, you are in the state of utter non-obstructiveness to the eternal reality, the indescribable, unthinkable eternal reality. You are now veritably the nexus, the focal point for the free entry and outflow of transcendent energies. But be very, very quiet and still all through it. Now, it's very easy to delude yourself that, oh, you have entered some wonderful deep realms of consciousness and so forth. It's very easy to do that. What is the one supremely necessary thing which would save us from that sort of delusion? Again, it is no other than purity, utter purity. whose fundamental factor is the total absence of all selfness, self-orientedness, egoism. If that is the case, then with the body and the psyche and the breath rhythm in tune with the fundamental rhythms of the earth, you will find that you are not self-deluded, that this is truth. And you will find that you are free from ecstasy. Ecstasy is a sign of disturbance which attends the isolative self-consciousness. Ecstasy means being beside yourself. Here you are just your own real, true, perfect self. And these, perhaps, are some of the things that may emerge in the course of that sort of meditative state. And this is a true meaning of meditation. And when these things emerge in that meditative state, then you are fulfilling your own unique spiritual destiny in life. Now, when you come out of that, or when that sort of state undergoes disturbance, the body will be unable to remain still, and so forth and so forth. The brain will start up again its usual activities. When this happens, don't try to go back to the other state of beatitude. You can never reproduce a beatitude. Creation is never the same twice over. Don't try to go back to it. But when you emerge, emerge as quietly as possible and remain as quiet as possible for as long as possible after the emergence. Get up, get about with your daily business and so forth. Now let us relate this to something which is fundamentally important to every human being in the world through the ages, and will be. Everyone longs for happiness. It doesn't matter what he says about it. Oh, I'm not interested in being happy. I'm interested in serving God or doing good or making a million within the next 6 months. You can just brush that aside. The living psychophysical existent, every single cell of that existent, is concerned with happiness. Now, it is a very interesting fact that of all the teachers, the teachers of the great religions, who all presented this matter of happiness and fulfillment and so forth, the Buddha specifically presents it in its negative aspect. He does not hold out any promise that you do so and so, which is good, and you will go to heaven, etc., etc. What he declares from the beginning is this: dukkha, the ill state, the evil state, the miserable state, the unhappy state, the suffering state, and the deliverance from dukkha is what I lay down. When he said, I lay down, that was the idiomatic form for which today we would say, this is what I teach, what I talk about, what I try to put before you. That's what it means. The ill state and the deliverance from the ill state. Now let us look at this word dukkha. The Sanskrit dukkha. Du means bad, spoilt, far from. Kha means, it's an expletive almost, it's hardly a proper word in the language. But kha means the infinite, the immeasurable. You might say, yes, or the absolute, the transcendent. Use any word like that you like, so long as the word in actual fact is quite indefinable. Whatsoever can be defined is limited and particular, which means it is subject to the overlordship of death. Whatsoever is finite and particular comes into being and dies. Today, tomorrow, 1,000,000,000 years hence. But it dies. It's under the lordship of death. And it is caught up within the sphere of conflicting duality, at least, if not of multiplicity. So, dukkha, the infinite spoilt, distorted, constricted, conditioned. Now you see how easily we misinterpret the teaching of the Buddha. Suffering, the ill state, all my pains, my liver troubles, my banking account being in a mess, or somebody has taken pictures of me in a compromising situation and so forth and whatnot. All that has nothing to do with the ill state in the supreme religious sense and the religious context. The religious context deals with what happens to your consciousness, your awareness, your mode of awareness of your existence. It is that which undergoes the transformation from the worldly state to the divine state, the perfect state. That is the whole story of the religious life. But because that is absolutely fundamental to our being, precedes our limited being and survives our limited being forever and ever. Because that is the case, all the lesser ills, the small demons, which are manifested in our lives as trouble and sorrow and perplexity and all the rest of it, they stem from that fundamental ill state. That is why all great teachers gave only one answer to every problem in the world. And it was the transcendent answer. And the transcendent answer is one which you and I cannot relate in the darkness of our self-centered way to the particular problems which confront us. Solve this, or rather resolve this fundamental discord, and everything else is resolved. There is no other way. And it's no good saying, yes, that's all very nice in the future, a wonderful future in eternity and so forth. But here, at this moment, before 12 o'clock, I have to solve this, that and the other problem. Whatever you do, if that problem is of that nature, to hell will I go. There is no way out. I have to get into hell over it. That's all. Because I have precipitated that hell. Having precipitated it, I say, no, now I don't want to endure this. Which is nonsensical. If I am foolish enough to step over a 2,000-foot precipice, for all my highfalutin' talk, the result at the bottom will be a mess. And no nonsense about it. Let's be perfectly commonsensical about it. All right. So now, this is the fundamental problem. You see? And it is this which we can tackle in terms of the ills that we see and which we experience in our daily life, the little ills. Those little ills have no existence for me apart from me myself. I am the producer of my inward disturbance in relation to those ills. I'll give you the extreme case which really practically no one can solve. Supposing I'm alone in the room. I'm saying alone to save you from all the horror of it. And suddenly the whole house is aflame all around me. Well, I burn and that's finished. And that's that. That's the end of it. But if I have that extraordinary insight and capacity developed to remain poised in mind inwardly, then that is the real solution of this particular problem of ill for me. The body will perish, of course. I've given you the extreme sort of type of case. There are physical things which nobody can deal with. If an earthquake takes place, Buddha and the disciples and heaven and hell will all get eaten. No, no. They probably won't. But most things will get eaten up in the earthquake. And that's that. We have to be very much aware of the that's that element in our physical existence. But this inner something is the thing we can tackle. And because we can tackle this inner something, we cease to be the producers of evil. Now you see, when all the sense functionings cease to imprison us, imprison one's consciousness, when all the thoughts, the ideas, the beliefs, the ambitions, and so forth, cease to imprison us, then there is that state of inner freedom, that inner peace, which is true happiness. It has no relationship to sensation, to sensational pleasure above all things. It has no relationship to pleasure. Pleasure is the most prolific, the most powerful, the most ubiquitous source of man's misery. The pleasure drive and pleasure seeking. Look, when the body is naturally healthy, when you're really healthy, and life, the life of the body just goes on perfectly by itself, you're unconsciously of it, you're unconscious of it, and you are spontaneously happy bodily. This is the happy state. You don't know it, you don't grab at it, and so forth. Very different thing. So you see, why the Buddha, in tackling this question of the ill state, always started off with the senses, understanding the functioning of the senses, understanding this pleasure drive, which is dependent upon the senses and the way they function, and above all, with the way we interpret that functioning and attach values to it. This is the main root of the trouble. He started off that way. And when one learns just to observe the functioning of the senses, really see them for what they are, every event, whether it be a painful event, sensationally painful or sensationally pleasurable, the body will record that, just like a thermometer records the temperature and a barometer records the atmospheric pressure. The body will just record all that naturally, but the mind will remain poised, not attached, bound to pleasure, not averse to pain, and therefore being violent towards it as a reaction. This is the simple way in which he presented it. But this way is identical with what we considered earlier this afternoon. The coming to an end of the senses and their effects doesn't mean that the senses, that one becomes senseless, far from it. The senses become far more acute and active. But this binding element has come to an end. All bondage is out. That is the real meaning of the coming to an end of the senses and the sense activities. The binding element is out. Now, when that happens, also with one's thoughts, one's so-called character pattern and all the rest of one's being, the whole lot, you know, sensations, thoughts, the sankhara, the discriminative consciousness and so forth, when it happens with all of them, and one has come to that state of repose, one is in the happy state. And it's a happiness that defies all definition. Principally, why does it defy definition? Because it is not finite. It is infinite. It is the happiness of the universe whose rhythm of existence is untroubled. It is man particularly who can get out of tune with that rhythm. And it is the glory of man that, having entered the pit, he discovers how to get out of that pit of darkness and consciously cooperate with the light. So you see, this longing for happiness in itself is perfectly natural and right. Happiness is an ingredient of truth, of the reality. Just as truth or beauty or goodness are just natural ingredients of the reality. These are the words we give to the one reality and the one all-encompassing experience of reality which we can have, merely to express the different shades, the variety with which we can experience this one total reality. Therein lies its beauty. So you see, watch carefully the pleasure drive. And it is so deeply hidden We may live 1,000 years and still keep on discovering how the pleasure drive is at work. It's an awful disturber of the peace. It's a most terrible destroyer of happiness, this pleasure drive. When the natural state of the whole psychophysical organism is the state of perfect poise, of freedom from attachment and aversion, then the organism is healthy. You are really healthy for the first time. You are whole, complete. And this is the meaning of holiness. If any one of us has actually experienced being in the presence of someone who has realized holiness, you will know what it is like to be in that presence. It doesn't overwhelm one. It doesn't disturb one. It doesn't make you happy in the kittenish sense. You are just happy with the happiness that is utterly indescribable. That is all. It becomes as simple and natural as opening your front door and going out for a walk in the woods on a beautiful day. And that's all. It's as natural as the act of opening the door and going out. You may get very ecstatic in the woods. You see, that's a different matter. I'm not talking of that. But the simplicity of the thing, you open a door. You all open doors and you don't attach any special happiness to it. But be in the state of poise and open a door and see what happens to your whole awareness of existence. Every single symbol, and every action is a symbolical action, every single symbol is infused with the living reality. And it is this which transforms the mind right into its innermost depths, and not only transforms oneself, the individual, but like the shining of the sun, is a light in your whole environment. And that is happiness.